Today on Wings, part two of Carolyn Gage's drama, The Second Coming of Joan of Arc.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. When we left our heroine, she was reviewing the deeds and miscalculations that led to her imprisonment.
I went to the governor gave me the escort, I went to the king gave me the army, I went to Orléans, I lifted the siege, I won all my battles, I took the king to be crowned, and all of these things happened for the same reason. I was 100% sure I was right. Which brings me back to Easter, 1430. The beginning of the end. Like I told you, I was standing on the walls of the city and the crowds were cheering and the bells were ringing, and then I heard my voices. And my voices told me that I would be captured soon. My voices never lied. My father lied. The king lied. The generals lied. The bishops lied. My voices, they never lied. 1 month after Easter, I was captured. Captured, hell. Like I told you, I was ditched. I mean, let's be honest, I can't even say I was betrayed. That might have required some forethought. No, I was ditched. So there I was, a prisoner of war, May 23rd, 1430. I was all of 18. For the first few days, I actually believed I would be rescued. I believed that the king would send the army to come get me. I would sit in my cell and imagine that I could hear the trumpets in the distance. That was June. By July, I said to myself, well, Jean, the king is holding back the troops. He's raising your ransom money. That was July. By August, I said to myself, well, Jean, they're negotiating. Charles is having trouble coming up with all that money. After all, you're not cheap. It never occurred to me that the king wouldn't save me. I was the bright promise and hope of France. I was a national hero. I was even more popular than the king. Of course he would save me. Right. That was August. By November, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what. The king was clearly not doing anything. But why? So like a detective, I began looking through the details of my brief but spectacular career for clues. And I thought back a year earlier to the scene at Rams. Okay, here it is. It's the cathedral at Rams, Coronation Day. It's a beautiful July day and the sun is streaming through the stained glass windows and the bells are all chiming and the air is sweet with the smell of incense and the pews are filled with soldiers and officers and counts and dukes and knights and their ladies all dressed in lace and satin and velvet and the priests and the bishops and the archbishops are all there. And here's the Archbishop of Reims wearing this beautiful robe made out of gold cloth. And here's Charles standing at the front of the church dressed like a king, waiting to be crowned according to ancient traditions passed on by generation after generations of French kings. And here, right up next to him, in the place of highest honor, is a 17-year-old peasant girl wearing full armor. Now, can you tell me what's wrong with this picture? You see, what everybody else knew and I didn't was that I'd broken all the rules. I mean, there I was. Strike one, a peasant. Strike two, a child. Strike three, a female. Big time strike three. I mean, any one of those is automatic out. I'm all three at the same time. If that's not bad enough, I'm outspoken, illiterate, and I'm dressed like a man. I mean, we're talking about somebody so far out in left field, they're beyond the bleachers. And all the same, there I was, right up there, in the place of highest honor. So, in December 1430, alone in my little prison cell, for the first time, I began to consider the people who'd been sitting in the pews that day. I mean, these people who had spent their whole lives playing by the rules. And they pass their titles and their property down to their oldest son, and they pass their daughters down to somebody else's oldest son. I mean, they arrange their entire lives around their real estate. This is considered high class. For the first time, I began to consider the high-ranking officers, the ones who are supposed to be driving the English out of France, or at least that's how I understood it. The army for them was a career, which explains why we're still fighting the Hundred Years' War. I mean, the first rule of promotion is cover your ass. That means make friends in high places, never challenge authority, and never ever do anything that involves the slightest personal risk. For the first time, I considered the men of God, the clergy. Well, they knew the good Lord helps them that help themselves, so that's what they did. They helped themselves to other people's property, other people's money, other people's daughters. The name of the game here is raise the most money in the name of the Lord, keep a low profile, and be able to cite some authority for all your actions, preferably the Bible, but anything in Latin will do. So here they are. All of these people, and they have devoted their whole lives to playing by the rules, inching their way along one square at a time. And here comes this peasant girl, nobody, and she takes a shortcut right past all their precious bloodlines and titles. And there she is, right up there next to the king. This peasant girl, nobody, who's never held any rank at all, but she's riding at the head of the army. This peasant girl, nobody, who belongs to a church that considers women so worthless they can't even be priests, and the angels are talking to her. I mean, something is obviously wrong. I mean, here are these people, and they have spent their entire lives waiting in line to buy tickets to see God. And they've made up all these elaborate rules to make sure they get the best seats in the house and everybody else has to take standing room and back. And here comes this peasant girl, nobody, walks right past a whole line of them, right into the theater, no ticket at all. Now, there's two conclusions they can draw. One, they have wasted their entire lives. Their place in line is meaningless. The reservations left in their name by their ancestors are meaningless. The fact they can afford box seats is meaningless. You don't need tickets to see God. And then there's the second conclusion. This girl is wrong. She is dead wrong. In December of 1430, on the eve of my 19th birthday, alone in my little prison cell, I finally figured out why there hadn't been any rescue or ransom and why there was never going to be any rescue or ransom. I was the enemy. That was December. In January, the Duke of Burgundy turned me over to the Church Inquisition. I was no longer a prisoner of war. I was a heretic. A woman who hears voices is a lot more dangerous than a woman with an army. Keep that in mind.
Thus concludes Act 1 of The Second Coming of Joan of Arc. During intermission, Wing speaks with the author and actor of this play. Carolyn Gage, how did you become a writer?
Well, it's interesting. I had lived my whole life until my early 30s, kind of like a movie. Three critical pieces of my identity were missing, that I was lesbian, that I was a survivor of child sexual abuse, and that I was an artist. And all of those identities emerged simultaneously, and I think that I could not have achieved any one of them without the support of the others. So that was when I found my voice. It's very hard to have a voice until you know who you are, and it's hard to know who you are if you don't remember your history or you're working out of the wrong sexual orientation and so on. So I came into my voice all in a rush. I suddenly had huge numbers of things to say that had been pent up for three decades. And so when I came into my voice, I became very, very prolific as a writer. And two decades later, I'm still pretty prolific. Still haven't run out of things to say.
This work that we're listening to, The Second Coming of Joan of Arc, is one of your pieces. What are some of the other things that you have been writing over these years?
I have a collection of one-act plays that's coming out this summer. I write a lot of plays that foreground the lesbian butch. I find her the most censored archetype in Western literature and probably global literature, because there is no identity that poses so severe a challenge to the myths that hold up patriarchy as the lesbian butch. So she's of endless interest to me. Plus, you know, it's an unmined vein, so I have enormous creative options. And I also write about the survivor of child sexual abuse who prevails and triumphs and thrives and recruits others. And that is also a narrative that's missing in the canon for obvious reasons. So I have about 50 plays, so rather than sort of talk about them one at a time, I would direct your listeners to my website, which is carolyngage.com. My whole catalog is online.
What attracted you to Joan of Arc? How did you latch onto this story that you're telling?
Well, actually, what we would call now her transgender appearance. I mean, Joan was so butch that on two occasions she was stripped and searched, and the crowds at her burning insisted that the body be taken down and again searched. They had a great deal of difficulty accepting that she was female, so I don't think this is just a cute little girl who put on pants. I mean, this is someone whose appearance, you know, intersex or transgender, whatever, was profoundly troubling to a very gendered society, and they needed to know, what is she, one or the other? And I think that that was the source of a lot of her strength and her power, and also of her witch hunting. And I think that that was one of the main reasons I was attracted to her, but also because she went up against, you know, she led an army, she crowned the king, and she also went up against the Pope in the Inquisition. And so she was really kind of operating at the highest levels of military, church, and state. And there's never been a woman in history that was on a collision course with all three of those branches of patriarchy at the highest levels. And she was 19 years old when she was killed. She was, I think, 18 when she was captured. So this was somebody kind of right at that cusp of resisting female socialization, a very hot time in every young woman's life. And at the same time, in that archetypal pivotal point, going up against all these institutions. So I just found the intensity of her journey and the drama of it was just overwhelming. And that she's such a precious archetype for us of female resistance.
Carolyn Gage, author and actor of The Second Coming of Joan of Arc. We continue with Act Two.
So, how do you torture a woman? Well, you can tie her up on the rack and rip her bones apart from the sockets. Or you can tear apart her mind and her body. Now, there's two ways you can do that. You can pry her body away from her mind, or you can pry her mind away from her body. Either way, it works out to the same thing. You stop the woman. She can think but not act, or she can act but not think. Now, if you want to pry her body away from her mind, you need to physically humiliate her. Of course, rape is the most traditional method, but it's not the only one by any means. You can ridicule her body. You can make fun of the things that she does. You can make her self-conscious about her looks. You can make her strap her breasts in. You can make her embarrassed about her periods. You can make her frightened of sex, frightened of puberty, frightened of aging, frightened of eating. You can terrorize a woman with her own body, and then she'll torture herself. Now, if you want to pry her mind away from her body, you need to make her believe she's crazy. I mean, you can put her in the courtroom and have all the experts certify that she's mentally incompetent, but again, there's a lot of other ways to go about this. You can just annul her. We all know how that goes. Interrupt her, change the subject, ignore her, patronize her, trivialize her, dismiss her. You can deprive her of her art, of her history, of her spiritual traditions. You can restrict her contact with other women. You can have a fit over women-only space. Like male dominant doesn't mean men only. You can lie to her so chronically and so comprehensively that that lie becomes the entire context for her existence.
You can cause her to doubt her own perceptions, and then if she's unable to change the way she feels, she really will believe she's crazy. It's not too hard to do if you control all the resources. And if you're a real expert at torture, you can do both at the same time. You can offer to love her body, if she'll just give up her mind. Or you can offer to love her mind and reject her body. Now, this is what I got. The Catholic Church had so much love for my soul, they just had to burn my body. On the other hand, they promised they'd take care of my body for the rest of my life, but just gave up everything that I knew was true. You think the days of the Inquisition are over? Every woman who's ashamed of her body is a victim of torture. Every woman who doubts her own judgment is a victim of torture. So you tell me, just how many women do you know who have not been pulled apart? So, my torture. Well, like I said, I got it both ways. In the prison cell, they were after my body. In the courtroom, they were going for my mind. I was moved to a castle in Rouen for the trial. My cell was cold and dark, and I was never allowed to leave it except to go to the courtroom. My feet were chained to a wooden block. It was uncomfortable, but it wasn't all that different from the other places I'd been prisoner for the last 8 months, except for one thing. I wasn't allowed to be attended by women. Now, in my cell in Rouen, I had a special detail of guards, 5 of them, English soldiers, 3 inside the cell with me, 2 outside the cell, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 5 months. They were animals. They insulted me, they threatened me, they degraded me, they ridiculed me. They never got tired of cruelty. They never gave me 1 minute of privacy. They polluted every square inch of the cell. They did everything they could except rape me. And that wasn't out of any respect for me. Now, there's 2 reasons why they didn't. First, I was difficult to get at because I was dressed like a man. I wore hose tied to the doublet at 20 points each, and I wore leggings that were tightly laced. And then, secondly, my virginity was an issue in the trial. You know, virginity being equated with credibility. So after the court had me examined to certify the presence of my hymen, well, the guards didn't dare do anything after that. Not because it would have been rape. Oh, no, not at all. No, because it would have been tampering with the evidence. But rape, of course, is not the issue. The fear of rape, as men have known for years, is just as effective as the real thing. The woman is afraid to live alone. She's afraid to go places by herself. She's scared of the dark. She's always looking over her shoulder, waking up in the middle of the night at the least sound. She is perpetually distracted, self-conscious, subverted, terrorized. She might as well have been raped, which is the whole point. In my little cell in Rouen, surrounded by my 5 guards, the atmosphere of rape was suffocating. And it had nothing to do with sex. It had to do with degradation. They wanted to make me despise myself. I chose to despise them instead. Anger's a discipline. I practiced my anger the way some people practice piano. It takes a lot of energy to be outraged. It's hard work, especially when the abuse becomes routine. Some days I was tired and sore and feeling sorry for myself. Some days I just wanted to pretend I didn't hear it. Some days I wanted to pretend I was above it all. But I would always say to myself, Jean, if you do not resist this abuse, you accept it. And if you accept it, you deserve it. And if you deserve it, you are a dead woman. And that's exactly what they want. So no matter how sick, how tired, how weak, I would always rise to the occasion. I would throw back the insult, protest the abuse, demand my rights as a human being. Of course, this had no effect on them, but it kept me alive. And I want to say something about my experience. I hear a lot of talk about women forgiving men. I don't believe it. I have experienced almost every form of cruelty that men can inflict on women, and I'm here to tell you that no woman can ignore it or forgive it, and furthermore, no woman should even try. There is no such thing as forgiveness. There is only resolution. With abuse, you resist it or you accept it. Period. Anything else is just fooling yourself. So, in the cell, I had to fight for my body. In the courtroom, I fought for my mind. Oh, let me tell you about my trial. I had two judges, three officers of the court, three notaries, an usher to escort me back and forth to the cell, 32 masters of theology, 16 bachelors of theology, 4 doctors of canon law, 7 men with special licenses, 7 medical doctors, 11 masters of arts, 16 assistants and expert witnesses, 23 priests, 5 abbots, 1 bishop, and a cardinal in a pear tree. After all, you can't be too careful with these teenage girls. My trial lasted 5 months and it focused on 2 issues. My voices and my clothes. Now, this seemed kind of strange to me at first because both of these things are so irrelevant. I mean, why would all of these important men be so interested in something so personal? I kept trying to, you know, skip over the questions or change the subject, but time after time, day after day, they kept coming back to those same 2 things, my voices and my clothes. Voices and my clothes. Of course. My perceptions and my identity. They knew exactly what they were doing. They wanted me to renounce my voices, that is, to invalidate my perceptions, and to wear a dress, that is, to alter my identity to suit them. Of course. Haven't we all? Oh, and there was something else that they were interested in. My attempt to escape. Men are always fascinated by women's attempts to escape, but only if we fail. If we succeed, they pretend we don't exist. My attempted escape? I had jumped off the roof of the castle where I'd first been held prisoner. Now, this was very interesting to them because they thought that I might have been trying to kill myself. I don't know how they came up with that. The tower was only 70 feet high. Yes, this little episode was very fascinating to them because trying to kill yourself is considered a sin. Now, what I want to know is why isn't it considered a sin to make a woman want to kill herself? Probably because that would put the Pope on the 10 most wanted list. So they kept asking me, when you jumped, were you trying to kill yourself? When you jumped, were you trying to kill yourself? And I would always say, I was trying to escape. Like there's some difference. So they didn't get what they wanted. But it didn't matter anyway, because the fact I didn't die from a 70-foot drop just proved I was a witch. And you know, there, I have to agree with them. Most of us women who survive our own best efforts at self-destruction are pretty miraculous, don't you think? Yes. So, on and on it went. Actually, for a while, I was holding my own. They would ask me these idiotic questions like, Jean, does St. Margaret and St. Catherine have hair? I'd say, yeah, you better believe it. Or, oh, God. They'd ask, like, Jean. When
Saint Michael appeared to you, was he wearing any clothes?
I say, what do you think? God's too poor to give him any. A lot of people would crack up. You know, I think a lot of people were secretly rooting for me. And I think my judge, Cochon, knew that too. I was supposed to have two judges, but one of them never showed up. Now, really, it was Cochon's baby. He had told everybody that he wanted to have a beautiful trial. I mean, this was going to be a career boost for him. He'd gone to the University of Paris, then they sent him to Rome, and they made him Bishop of Beauvais, and he was moving right on up the old ladder. But then he ran into a snag with the war, and he had to choose which side he was on. Well, all of his rich friends in Beauvais were for the English, so he decided he was too. That worked out fine until I came along and the French started to win. 2 years before this trial, all of his hotshot friends got run out of Beauvais and he lost his territory. So now this refugee bishop was going to use this trial to stage his big comeback. That's why he invited all these prominent men to see it. And here I was making a monkey out of him. Now, let me tell you something about men. They can't stand to lose face. Now, it's difficult for us women to understand how very important this is to men because we've never been allowed to have enough face to lose. I mean, we tend to be concerned with things like the justice of an issue or finding a peaceful solution. It's difficult for us to understand how the most important thing, even in the case of an all-out war, is to find some way for all of the men involved to save face. I mean, it would be funny how childish they are, except that these children are running the world, and they have almost ruined it. And these rules of face-saving are hard on women. When a woman challenges a man, it is not enough that he prove her wrong. Now, to save face, he has to annihilate her. And this is what Cochon was out to do. After the sixth day in court, he moved the trial to my prison cell. No more audience. Just him, few assistants, and the notaries. Things went downhill for me. You see, without the pressure of the spectators, I couldn't make him skip over questions anymore. I had to give him what he wanted. So when it was all over, 5 months and hundreds of pages later, this is what they came up with. Here are my crimes. 1, disobeying my parents and causing them anxiety. 2, dressing like a man. 3, taking a vow never to have sex with men. Can't imagine why. 4, listening to voices on the sole basis that they brought me comfort. 5, believing in those voices without the church's permission. And 6, refusing to acknowledge the church's right to judge my actions. These were my crimes. And if you think they don't burn women for them anymore, you can ask any dyke. She'll tell you.
To hear the stirring conclusion of the second coming of Joan of Arc, tune in next week to Wings. For more about Wings and to listen online, check the website www.wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of Il Dono, The Gift. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.